Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, you know, it's earnings season, so we would be remiss if we didn't talk some earnings, but also a big announcement this week outside of their earnings at Walmart that we'll discuss. We'll also talk a CEO departure at Bed Bath & Beyond. A reminder to like us, rate us, however you find us out there, whether it's iTunes or some other podcast listening service. You can also check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we lead off today's show with legacy department store Macy's as they released earnings on Wednesday morning. And honestly, it touched off what was a promising 24 hours for retail earnings calls preceding Walmart's on Thursday. Walmart's was all over the headlines on Thursday, the day that we're recording this. Now, there was some worry going into the call overall for Macy's, not necessarily regarding Macy's individually, but U.S. retail figures fell in April. So if you were looking at the headlines kind of early on in the week, it was getting people into a bearish spirit, and we really haven't had a ton of uplifting retail earnings calls. We've had solid ones, but there have been a bit of negativity in terms of forecasts and that type of thing. And I think that kind of set the tone for this. But Leighton, it was something we were talking about before we came on the air here. When you look deeper into the U.S. retail numbers as a whole, this fall in April seemed to be driven by mostly automotive purchases, or rather lower than expected automotive purchases. And we always exclude those from our numbers anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing we don't talk about is car sales, but maybe we should one day. But honestly, it's not something we've ever really looked at, but it is a part of most retail figures throughout the United States. So whether you're looking at a larger macroeconomic view or sort of a micro view of certain markets, it is sort of a bellwether for how the economy is doing overall. But we should be mindful that this slew of earnings calls from the retail industry as of late does include very little, if anything, from April, but would include a March that was very robust in respect to other previous months, according to the U.S. economic data industry-wide. Still, there were a number of analysts cautioning against expecting a positive retail earnings season. So far, things are actually looking pretty decent on the whole for the retail industry. And getting to this earnings call, Macy's, again, ticker M, if you follow them on the stock market, analysts expected 31 cents per share in adjusted earnings, at least based on Zacks consensus estimates. And Macy's blew by this number, posting 44 cents in adjusted earnings per share. To put this in perspective for our listeners, this is their fourth consecutive positive earnings surprise when based on the Zacks numbers, of course, and the third time in four quarters that the number is actually a positive surprise, greater than 20%. So when you're really looking at analyst expectations here, you can see that they should be rather pleased with Macy's and their performance on the bottom line. We don't often discuss Macy's since they are often so heavily covered in the media. CEO Jeff Gennette said in a recent CNBC interview that he has high hopes for the company. He's always on there as a guest and really open to discussing all about the retail industry and Macy's initiatives, of course, in particular. However, we wanted to circle back to Macy's this quarter. Again, we don't cover them every single quarter, but this quarter was interesting, Trent, because some of the numbers from the call were actually pretty interesting to us, and we wanted to follow up on an earlier looking ahead segment where we were discussing their store within a store initiatives. And so now, for all of the talk about their earnings beat, their comp store sales were actually pretty timid. So this is the one thing that didn't really hit the major headlines, but a lot of people would look at this and say, well, retail isn't that strong. But keep in mind, Macy's is a massive powerhouse, and like we said at the beginning, a legacy retailer. So their numbers actually weren't bad when you say that and put that in perspective. They increased their same-store sales 0.6% on an owned store basis. And when you include sales from licensing agreements, those licensed stores helped them out a little bit to boost that figure to 0.7% in aggregate. This was in line with prior guidance, which forecasted flat to 1% growth on comp store sales front in the 2019 fiscal year, down from 1.7% for owned stores in 2018. This is their sixth straight quarter of comp growth for those keeping track. This was a function of a whopping 5.7% increases in transactions, meaning hopefully more humans are actually going to their stores, but a 2.2% in decline in units per transaction and another modest decline in amount per transaction. So if you look at the bigger scale of things and how they're operating, sales in the Midwest, those Midwest stores and Northeastern U.S. stores actually ended up improving the most, which actually ended up surprising some. While they noted that sales from international tourists fell about 3.1% in the first quarter, and you may be scratching your head wondering how they're able to keep track of those international tourists, I was doing the same thing. We'll talk about this a little bit later. We'll gloss over it a little bit, but they're able to keep track of credit card data and where those clients or where those customers are actually coming from in order to make those United States purchases. Their adjusted earnings per share figure also puts them in good shape to meet initial full year earnings per share guidance, as they were guiding for full year earnings per share around $3 to $3.25. We have to keep in mind most of their earnings per share does in fact come from their fiscal fourth quarter. We are talking retail here, and we are talking big holiday seasons, especially this past year in 2018, where before they had guided just for flat net sales. Their net sales were actually down by just a hair, from around $5.541 billion in 2018 to $5.504 billion in 2019, a very, very modest drop for them, around 0.7%. So what this means is they were actually a bit more profitable than expected on a reduced amount of top-line revenue. That said, they were less profitable than last year, where earnings per share came in at around 48 cents. So this is basically why we wanted to discuss the earnings call in the first place. How are they extracting margins on their decreased sales, and what their progress on their five major initiatives for this year and how they're coming along?
So let's talk about those margins first. There wasn't actually a lot in the prepared statements or the press release about margins. In fact, Jeanette, he's a very polished individual, talked mostly about their top line growth potential in the press release, and then on the earnings call talked a lot about these five initiatives that we'll discuss. But CFO Paula Price did mention that credit card revenues were actually up 9.6% from last year, and that certainly helps to contribute to the bottom line. Now, generally speaking, this isn't always the case, but generally speaking, credit card revenues tend to run a higher margin than product sales revenues. In this case, the revenues were pushed by higher finance charges related to higher balances. So more people carrying high balances on the credit cards results in higher interest rates that they're paying back, and essentially that money going back into Macy's pockets. They also noted credit card penetration was up 80 basis points. Now it sits at a whopping 46.3% of their customer base, which is astounding when you look at those numbers. One of the highest credit card penetration rates in the retail industry. But on the other end of things, the main drag on their bottom line was actually higher delivery expense, which Price said was the major contributor to an 80 basis point decline in gross margin rate overall. And delivery expense, something that Walmart actually addressed this week in their news. We'll talk about that in our next story. But the company noted that margin on merchandise remained relatively stagnant versus last year's first quarter. That's not something that they wanted to see, although it's certainly better than seeing that margin shrink. But largely, the stagnation is due in part to spring inventory, which proved a bit of a weight to the balance sheet. So they may have to move some of this inventory through promotional measures as we get closer to summer. So once again, increased delivery expense because they're getting more traffic through mobile means and more traffic through their online website. And they got a bit of a benefit from those credit card sales going up and from revenues from credit cards going up. Now further, the company saw a $29 million SG&A increase, or selling, general and administrative expense increase, over the prior year's quarter. Much of this coming in internal investment into those five strategic initiatives that we keep talking about. So in the end, merchandise margin is remaining steady. Their overall margins are only compressing because of shipping costs and internal investment. Now, the company may need to find a solution going forward, particularly regarding shipping costs. Now, as we'll talk about, so many of their initiatives tie in with digital. They're very bullish, particularly on their app and their mobile customers, as their mobile customer base growing faster than any other customer base that's out there. With that, you're going to see increased shipping costs for those that aren't buying online, picking up in store. So they've got to find some solution there to keep those margins from continuing to shrink, because they are so bullish on their increased sales with their mobile and online presences. So now let's discuss where they're at on the five initiatives. And this all starts with discussing what those initiatives are. So how we'll kind of structure this is we'll go through each initiative, talk about what it is, and we'll talk about the progress made in the first quarter on that initiative. So we'll kind of go through one by one. It's as deep of a dive as we're going to do on a retailer, really, on the podcast. So the first initiative was once known as Growth 50 for the company. Now that's changed to Growth 150. The idea here is to implement a different store model to 50 original kind of flagship stores was the idea, but now that's up to 150 stores throughout the chain and gradually scaling up from there. So it started with 50, now it's 150, looking at potentially more in the future. Now they implemented this originally in 50 stores in 2018, and those stores showed not only higher sales overall, but higher customer retention as well. Now the process implementation here includes small things like upgrades to fixtures, the likes of which a company like Sears hasn't really done over the past several years, but also staffing augmentations, not just staffing augmentations, but also deploying staff in a correct way in the stores and kind of rethinking how they're deploying staff in the stores, but also making a different training approach there to customer service for their staff. And that's among many other things that they mentioned for this Growth 150 progress. Now, they're in the midst of adding stores to this very same growth portfolio. Again, 100 stores expected to be added before the end of the fiscal year. So right now, in the first quarter, really more of a build-out stage here as they started to add more stores to this growth portfolio. But they did note that through the first quarter, the original Growth 50 stores back from 2018 continued to outperform the others in sales with the second initiative, Layton.
Yeah, their second initiative that we're going to be talking about is their Backstage concept, and pretty much something that we try to highlight every single time we talk about a Macy's earnings call because it gets brought up either by analysts or by the leaders of the company, which makes sense because it really has shown that they can bring in a different demographic to those Macy's stores, those full-price stores or historically full-price stores. And if you look at it, it's really building out a store within a store concept that we actually have liked for some time now, but it's really gaining momentum within the executive leadership teams. And basically, they're branding this as an on-mall, off-price concept. And coming into the quarter, they had installed 165 store within a store Backstage locations, with 121 locations opening in 2018. So you can really see that momentum taking hold for the company. And again, the positive momentum that they're seeing, it must really be turning into positive revenue for the company, top line figures really contributing there. And in the first quarter, they opened 9 additional Backstage stores and expect an additional 50 to be added by the third quarter. So again, keeping on with that growth story, this initiative was started in part to drive additional traffic to stores, which I just mentioned. And the hope here being that some of the Backstage only traffic would spill over into the full price portion of the store. This is logical. This would essentially increase margins and increase the customer base that historically did not shop at Macy's previously. So to date, that seems to be at least partially the case. So their thesis is holding true, but the overlap is likely a bit less than Macy's would like. And we would always like better progress on that front. In particular, with those store within a store concepts, you would like to see those customers shopping every corner of the store, not just one section of it. Only around 15% of customers shop both Backstage and the main stores, to put that in perspective. However, those that shop at both concepts spend about 25% more than the average Macy's customer. So they are finding that within this subset, Backstage drives around 2 additional trips over the course of the year. Then we break into our third initiative here. With that said, we talk about the e-commerce realm and their vendor direct initiative. The term omnichannel was used a ton in their earnings call, but really their vendor direct program is targeted entirely towards their online and mobile presence. You see that the idea here is that the vendors can have an increased presence on the Macy's website and an ability to sell directly through Macy's platforms without needing to funnel the merchandise through Macy's systems. In quarter one, Macy's added 142 new vendors and 334,000 new SKUs to their website overall, a very pronounced initiative here, such that Macy's has nearly doubled their overall available SKUs online since 2018. Those 334 new SKUs is approximately 1/3 of what Macy's expects to add in the fiscal year as a whole,
and they expect to add around 850 more vendors before the end of the year. Notable vendors added in the first quarter, by the way, include Happy Socks, Urban Originals, and Lacoste. Macy's did credit Vendor Direct on the call as being a major driver behind their double-digit increase year-over-year in digital sales. Around 10% of online sales, the company said, come through Vendor Direct now, really showing progress in this particular initiative.
Speaking of digital sales, their fourth initiative that they're really focusing on, driving traffic to mobile, which we mentioned earlier. Mobile's credited as Macy's fastest-growing sales channel in the company, looking to continue that growth by allowing greater functionality, but also more convenience at checkout. And by that, we don't only mean checkout within the app, but also how they're getting the actual product, particularly buy online, pickup in store. Now, all of this focus on mobile was evidenced by the fact that Macy's mentioned mobile on the earnings call and their app more than any other retailer on a call that I've been on this year, at least. It was amazing. It seemed like every other word was talking about their mobile sales or their app and app development. Now, the features that they've been working on for the first quarter include different in-app options. So those include what they call My Wallet, which allows customers to pick up items in-store in an expedited fashion. It also allows connection to mobile pay once they get to the store. There's also My Store, which gives customers more direct access to local offers and recommendations. Also can be used for in-store wayfinding, which is not something new to a store or retailer's app. In fact, we've talked about it before, but you know, Toys R Us, Walmart, driven this out in past years. So Macy's looking to add this to their app with development in the first quarter. And then there's My Stylist, which might connect customers to those that can provide fashion input maybe for those that want it, or to personal shoppers there. Now, all of these were put into development motion during the first quarter, but Macy's also initiated tests in Q1 on quick in-store pickup systems, or at least quicker in-store pickup systems. And they're also looking at integrating big-ticket furniture items into the app as well, kind of making it easier for customers to purchase those items and then pick those larger furniture items up in the store. Now, finally, their fifth initiative here, Macy's is embarking on a wide-ranging initiative. This is kind of a catch-all initiative that they're calling Destination Business. To put it shortly, they're attempting to make their brand more attractive to customers through brick and mortar and merchandising enhancements. And quite literally, their update on this was, and I quote, "We saw strength in our destination businesses in the quarter," but if you parse this out a little bit, they mean really they saw strength in their six top categories. This initiative is really more about pushing them into the top of the market share leaders in their six top categories. They feel like they're already there among three of their six top categories. So it's really about focusing on their strengths. Also putting their best staff members in these categories. Back to what we talked about in the first initiative when we're talking about deployment of staff. What they're using is kind of a strength-on-strength staffing model. So they're looking to put strong staff into strong categories as a hope to really establish themselves as the market leaders in those particular categories. Now, other retailers will sometimes play it out a little bit differently. They'll put highly regarded staff members in struggling categories in an effort to prop them up. Isn't the case here, but I remember many moons ago when I worked for Kmart, one of our best managers at the Kmart actually got shifted over to seasonal because seasonal was struggling so much at the time. And this is, you know, pre-first bankruptcy, really. But it was struggling so much at the time that it needed propped up. So they put a good manager on seasonal. And sure enough, it seemed to work out. But what Macy's is doing here is putting those good managers, good supervisors, high-selling salespeople into the categories that are already doing pretty well because they feel like there's a lot more white space to gain and they feel like by gaining market share in those categories, they can be top of mind more for consumers when they think about who to get certain products from. Now, a few other smaller initiatives were mentioned on the call as well. They launched Story at Macy's earlier this year, 36 locations in total across 15 states, another store within a store concept. The launch all came after the acquisition of Story in 2018, which was actually a freestanding store, started in New York, became known for many brand partnerships there, but is being used basically in Macy's to trumpet products from smaller to mid-sized brands, although one of the products they rolled out this year in their stores was from Crayola, and I'm not sure I'd be willing to call Crayola a smaller or mid-sized brand. The concept here, though, is that the merchandising and the events within the space will change 4 to 5 times per year. So you think about it, it's very onerous, it's very staff heavy with these because you have to change those over. But they're hoping on basically becoming a destination for people, and also when they change over those concepts, to drive people into the stores. Now, if you've been to one of these so far since their launch, which took place back in April, you'll know that they're banking on color for their first theme to draw people in and give people a reason to return. And I know we're on a podcast here, so it's an audio medium, but just to kind of put the image in your head, if you haven't been to one of these, if you haven't seen pictures of one of these, it basically looks like you took Rainbow Road from Mario Kart and put it into a retail concept. I don't know how many people in our listener base have played Mario Kart, hopefully all of them, but if you think about Rainbow Road on Mario Kart, just that overload of color, every single color in the rainbow over and over and over again, it's exactly like that, except, you know, there are probably barriers and that type of thing to keep people in the store from falling off the side.
Well, Trent, you've really dated yourself, first with Kmart, now with Mario Kart and Rainbow Road, so our listeners now think you are extremely old or are still a child inside. But overall, we can certainly see the difference between a business like Macy's, in all seriousness, and one like JCPenney. Both companies listed on the stock market, one has done way better than the other, but they often get lumped together when retail analysts talk about mall retail or legacy retail in general. As much as JCPenney would like to embark on some of these same strategic initiatives, they really just don't have the free cash flow to do so, whereas Macy's has maintained somewhat consistent profitability, and as we mentioned throughout the duration of this podcast, positive earnings per share releases versus analyst expectations. And yes, you could look at their balance sheet and see that they have around $4.2 billion in long-term debt, similar to what JCPenney has. However, they're able to have a higher return on equity, have a higher return for shareholders. And by the way, they own a truckload of real estate. So if you look at their available assets on their balance sheet, much healthier than JCPenney. The main question going forward for them is just how much will these strategic efforts on behalf of Macy's management result in increases in revenue long term, and more importantly for shareholders, the bottom line? It's early, but so far the answer is not by much, although we should say that it's doing a far better job as a retailer than a lot of people were estimating maybe just 4 or 5 years ago. We move on to our second story, another massive retailer, this one being Walmart, the largest retailer in the United States by volume. Walmart dropped what appeared to be a bombshell this week, announcing free next-day delivery and an obvious jab to Amazon. Amazon, of course, always being in the news as well. Next day, by the way, spelled without a space in between, so keep that in mind as far as it being more of a branding move than anything else. Walmart really trying to enhance their brand. Walmart most recently dropping the hyphen from their name and just having Walmart out there for the masses. And this news actually was delivered via a press release on Walmart's website. The byline credited Mark Lohr. Mark Lohr, we all remember Mark Lohr from his days at Jet.com, the president and CEO of Walmart's U.S. e-commerce division now. In other words, we're made to believe the message is coming straight from him, their leader in e-commerce. Ordinarily, we discredit the notion that the initiative is aimed specifically at taking market share from Amazon, but in this case, the headline gives it away. It really tells you that they are going straight at Amazon's customers and Amazon's initiatives, which they have been touting over the last several years. It reads, free next day delivery without a membership fee. The last half of the headline is directly referencing Prime, of course. We attempt to keep in mind that Amazon has constantly sought to add value to their Prime membership via, let's say, video and music. So all of those streaming services, Trent, Whole Foods initiatives or other endeavors that are talked about in the masses. So Prime is more than just free two-day shipping. They want to make it a platform that is an imperative for the average U.S. customer. They are trying to attract nearly everybody who makes a decent income in the United States to keep that membership for the long term. Still, this is Walmart's clear value plea to consumers. You don't have to spend money on a membership in order to make a convenience buy and to get your items quickly. You can do so without a membership, even if you don't get that streaming service, even if you don't get those
extremely modest Whole Foods decreases. However, the program does have limitations, especially from the customer's perspective. And this announcement can be looked at through two perspectives. That said, the customer's perspective and the corporate one. First, Trent, we're going to be talking about the customer's perspective.
Yeah, I'll let you have the corporate perspective since you're a little bit more buttoned up there. But as far as the customer's perspective is concerned, there are some limitations there. And that's why I think, you know, a lot of headlines were saying, you know, this is a shot across the bow of Amazon and all of this stuff. But I just don't necessarily think it's going to work out that way because of the hitches in the plan. Now, this isn't a universal plan just yet. That's the first thing we need to mention. Despite the headlines that you might have seen, it will be a limited rollout initially. That's something that a lot of people have been glossing over a little bit with their coverage. Initially, the next day delivery program will be available in the Phoenix and Las Vegas metro areas. After that, Layton's Home in Southern California, all within the span of the next few weeks. Lore's release said over the next few months, the rollout will eventually expand until it reaches 75% of the U.S. population by the conclusion of 2019. So we are talking about quite a bit of the U.S. population, but it will leave out some metros. According to Walmart, it'll include 40 of the top 50 major U.S. metros. So 10 of the top 50 major U.S. metropolitan areas kind of left out of this program, as well as, of course, a lot of rural areas, one would think, because it's centered around distribution centers, which Layton will talk about in a second. But as with some of their grocery pickup and the same-day grocery delivery programs, again, you're going to see it probably take a while before it reaches those small to mid-sized markets that Walmart has so long cut their teeth in. Now, just like with the availability of the program, there are limitations to products that will be included. Now, as with Prime and really any retailer's expedited delivery promotions, there are exclusions here as far as items are concerned. You can't, let's say, buy a couch and get it next day delivered. But Walmart has set aside 220,000 products for the next day platform. So while not 100% of their website, that is a good number of SKUs included. Not all of the products, though, will be universal. So if you order products in Phoenix, it might look a little bit different than when you order products in Southern California or Las Vegas. They're trying to kind of localize these SKUs based on market and region and based on what that distribution center that's fulfilling these is willing to carry. Also, there's a minimum purchase amount of $35. Now, $35 is a pretty common purchase amount for free shipping. If you do any e-commerce shopping, you see that a lot. Our friends over at Brandless use $35 as the free shipping threshold there too. But the reality is this may be a difficult sell to shoppers who are used to making quick one or two item purchases through a platform like Amazon. My wife, for example, will do that. She will make 3 to 4 separate Amazon purchases throughout the day, and Amazon will then send them each in its own package. So Walmart's trying to get away from this here because there is that minimum purchase amount. Basically, customers will have to save up until they have enough to get above that $35 threshold or keep shopping until they get above that $35 threshold to take advantage of the free next day shipping. And while it'd be easy to dismiss this as an easy threshold to reach, having any minimum amount whatsoever can cause consumers to rethink things. For example, Walmart gives diapers and laundry detergent as examples of products available through the platform. But you look at laundry detergent, you look at a gallon jug of Purex or something like that, you're going to have to order a lot of that to add up to $35. So this isn't as much of a convenience play as it is just basically a substitute for a shopping trip minus groceries. And then from the customer's perspective, using the website to use the next day service will actually require just a little bit of work. First, customers, of course, will have to sign in and choose their local market to be eligible for it. Then they'll have to sort their view by products that are available for next day delivery. So only certain products, of course, on the website will be available for next day delivery. This can be done actually through a toggle button on the screen for those that are in those markets serviced by this. But this is kind of where the similarities with the Amazon Prime program ends, because you can see on Amazon, if you're shopping, of course, you have that Prime logo that shows up next to products that are Prime eligible. But the reality is, on Amazon, you can put Prime products into your cart next to non-Prime products, and Amazon will parse those out and send them in different ways. But for Walmart, everything in the cart must be eligible for next day delivery in order for the order to qualify for the program. So you have to have at least $35 of next day qualified products in order for this to trigger that next day delivery. And we can see this as being a major issue for customers who might accidentally have a non-eligible item in their cart. But it also causes inconvenience in the form of needing to submit two orders if they need something that doesn't qualify for their next day delivery. And Walmart's platform, a little bit less convenient than Amazon's platform, let's face it, when it comes to using that. But I think realistically, this is a major hurdle because anyone who's ever worked in IT, anyone who's ever tried to guide someone else through a website, you know that there are a lot of consumers out here that aren't necessarily web savvy. And even the web savvy among us might miss that little next day tag and might accidentally have a next day item in their cart. So this will cause them to maybe back up or wonder why that next day delivery isn't showing up when they go to check out. So again, another possible hiccup with the program. And then the third issue that the customer might have is that they have to submit their order by their market's cutoff time for next day delivery. And here we have to underscore the necessity of consistency for Walmart. If you are going to create habitual users for this next day delivery program, you have to keep things consistent. And considering inconsistencies with Walmart's in-store experience, like for example, closing self-checkouts at seemingly random times at Walmart neighborhood markets, sometimes 8, sometimes 10, it will be crucial for them to set a cutoff and leave it, or if anything, make that cutoff later, because what you don't want to have happen is for a tired shopper to be online and then realize, oh, they missed the cutoff by an hour because that cutoff got moved up from the last time they used that next day delivery service. So those are the potential issues from the customer's perspective that I can see here. And those are some of the limitations in the plan. But what was interesting is this press release went about talking about the corporate perspective and how it might actually be a positive thing for Walmart's margins. And because Layton's all about money, that's what he's going to talk about.
Yeah, and you see a lot of press releases from Walmart when they have these huge steps, these big moves that they make, and it really adjusts their stock price. It gets analysts talking, but not a lot of it is corporate centric, if you will. A lot of the times they talk about from the customer perspective only and how they want to constantly enhance the customer experience and how customer service is really key in their business. So anytime they're talking about, let's say, something that really does involve the finance side of the business, let's say higher wages, they talk about what it's actually going to do for those people coming in every day and making those common purchases and how that's going to please their transaction, not necessarily what it's going to cost the company during a particular quarter. However, Trent, I will say from all of your consumer perspective, our listeners are probably thinking that you are, in fact, very old. Not only the Mario Kart references, but also saying that maybe you have some problems using the internet, which you're probably going to have to get used to if you do plan on buying some of these items online. But it was especially odd for us in this press release, or what was basically Laura's statement, to see a large section on how it's going to be a good business move or make good business sense for the company as a whole. Typically, Walmart's news items are geared much more towards the customer. Like I said, they have the customer in mind. They have them at the forefront of their business with these sort of statements. And Walmart claims that next day delivery service will actually cost less to execute than the previous 2-day shipping the company has floated in the past. And at least according to Lore, this is because next day delivery will function through regional fulfillment centers, meaning the merchandise, in theory, has less distance to travel to get to one's home. So basically, each of these fulfillment centers will have a curated amount of items, those 220 or so thousand items that the customer has access to in their given market. Again, in a particular market, but when a customer orders items that are on the next day list or that are next day compliant, the fulfillment center will then package the order and ship through ground shipping. This, in theory, will reduce packaging as Walmart will be able to pack the product in as few boxes as possible. And it's funny because, listen, we've all ordered from Walmart.com or Amazon and had the order come in a comical amount of different boxes, an array of boxes that maybe come from different distributors or different package handlers. Sometimes one box for each different item is ordered. In Amazon's case, at least I have experienced that. And this costs money, of course, not only for Amazon, but
for everyone involved in sending each package out via its own shipping method. So Walmart claims to be able to save money in two ways. First, by sending out fewer packages in total, and by using standard ground shipping versus expedited shipping methods. And so Walmart credits their existing supply chain network for allowing them to roll out the platform in the first place. While Amazon's supply chain is fairly robust on its own, they lack the distribution facilities that Walmart has built out due to their brick and mortar presence. One wonders if some of those closed Sam's Clubs we were talking about last year will serve as distribution facilities for certain markets that are underserved by Walmart. Think Seattle, for example.
Now, let's take a look at how much this program will have a noticeable effect on Walmart's bottom line. Well, as we always say, time will tell, but we find it difficult to see that this is the massive, again, blow to Amazon after Amazon mentioned that they were rolling out next day shipping on a limited basis. And a lot of analysts and media members have kind of speculated that it's going to be a shot to Amazon here. But again, you know, it's going to be back and forth, and the number of exclusions and intricacies of the program similar to Amazon's from the customer perspective make it a little bit more cumbersome for customers, but particularly it seems like there are more issues with the Walmart platform than there might be with the Prime program. Now, if customers do develop a habit of using the service, it might eventually assist Walmart in grabbing market share from other retailers, maybe not Amazon, but others. As far as helping their bottom line, though, it's difficult to see too much of a benefit, although, of course, as Leighton mentioned, lore says otherwise because they'll no longer be paying for expedited shipping necessarily, but just be using regular ground shipping for a lot of these packages and clustering the items together. But it's building that habit among customers that'll be the biggest step and overcoming the initial obstacles to the program for the customers to get used to it. And I know Leighton took a bit of a dig at my internet savviness. I'm rather internet savvy, I would say, but a lot of people are already in the habit of using Prime. So sometimes it's difficult to pull them out of that habit, and you find it difficult to believe that they'd up and cancel their Prime memberships just because of this. If anything, this might be more of a play towards those who don't have a Prime membership or can't rationalize it because of maybe limited income. So they can't rationalize paying the amount for the Prime membership each year. But you wonder if there's enough of a subset of this population, kind of the middle of the Venn diagram in the U.S., to make a meaningful difference to Walmart versus those same people that would be going to Walmart's brick and mortar locations and shopping there anyway. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't at least reference Walmart's latest earnings call as they reported first quarter earnings this week. Look, the earnings were great. Earnings per share came in at $1.13 per share versus consensus estimates of $1.02 per share. And that's per Refinitiv data regarding the analyst consensus estimates. Revenue came in a little bit below target estimates, but Walmart was more profitable on the revenue that they did make. $123.93 billion is how much Walmart brought in with revenue. Same store sales up 3.4% versus an analyst increase of 3.3%. That was their largest first quarter jump in same store sales in 8 years. One of their other notes, e-commerce sales grew 37%, largely driven by home and fashion. And again, we're seeing these high double-digit increases for Walmart's e-commerce sales. So it's hard to second-guess too many of the rollouts regarding their e-commerce platforms. Like I said, I am a little bit critical of the one-day shipping, but one thing you can't argue with, you know, since Mark Lohr has taken over the e-commerce division for Walmart, they have been killing it quarter after quarter, year after year. And so to see e-commerce sales grow once again 37%, you have to like that as a whole for Walmart. Like I said, just not so sure about this program really catching on in a wholesale way.
A lot of people were saying, well, they need to at least hit 40% to show true growth, but I don't think a 3% difference or a 30 basis point difference is really that big of a deal. You can take away that maybe Trent, Sam's Club e-commerce sales were up just 28%. However, Sam's Club, led by a different team, even though they're under one corporate umbrella, they operate a little bit differently, of course. And by the way, even though they hit revenue marks just a little slightly less than maybe analyst expectations, overall revenue still rose for the company. And this, as they're divesting certain international divisions, and they're really taking their foot off the gas for what their strategy was 6 to 7 years ago, which is buy international in order to grow. And now it's more like
reinvest in the United States in order to grow e-commerce. So that structural change has really done wonders for the company, and I think it's made them sustainable for the long term, because at the end of the day, you can grow internationally, sure, but the majority of the revenue still comes from the United States. And with that, I will be the one to introduce our last story for this podcast. The Container Store had high analyst expectations coming in to their earnings call most recently. But you see, after market close on Tuesday, after they announced, for the most part, they delivered on their expectations and then some. In the past, we've been cautious surrounding the Container Store, calling them a company that may have been better off staying private at times, and they seem to be more focused on corporate social sustainability and responsibility than other publicly traded retailers, and they've insisted on investments in staffing and on their employee benefits despite margins that were maybe growing a little bit smaller quarter after quarter. However, the company has been looking better financially as of late in terms of how they're doing at the bottom line, but then also how they're performing on a store-by-store basis. And that was really underscored in this week's earnings call, which was their fiscal 2018 fourth quarter. And Trent, we're going to discuss those call details. But first, let's discuss expectations. The Zacks consensus estimates were for adjusted earnings per share to come in at just 31 cents. For comp sales, analyst estimates predicted a 3.1% growth margin. There was a slight beat on earnings, which came in at 33 cents per share on an adjusted basis, of course. This was up from around 18 cents in the fourth quarter of last year, so year over year, almost doubling. But the big news for the retailer, Trent, and the main reason for their stock popping around 10% on the call this Tuesday was their comp sales. In addition, they reaffirmed an outlook for fiscal 2020 on the higher side of estimates. Those comp sales, you ask, those were a whopping 8.5% greater than last year. This is a number that's pretty much been unheard of in earnings calls so far this year. And for even the best of retailers, we're not seeing numbers crossing maybe the 5 or 6% mark.
And that increase pushed their full year comps, which we now got since this is their fiscal fourth quarter, up to 3.5%. That's a pretty dramatic increase from the earlier quarters, the 8.5% was. Now, a heavy portion of their fourth quarter increase, they said about 380 basis points, in fact, came from their custom closets portion of their business. And that's something they've been trying to push for some time, but it's almost serendipitous for the Container Store that they were pushing this line at the same time popular culture has kind of caught on to closets and organization. And in fact, it was odd to hear on the earnings call, but it was actually refreshing, I think, to hear the CEO, Melissa Reif, credit popular culture in part for the comp increase. She mentioned the Marie Kondo effect, referencing the popular Netflix series Tidying Up, on not only boosting the closets category, but also the rest of their storage core as well. Now, net sales were up at their mainline stores 10.1% due to those comps that Layton talked about, but also a few new store openings. They did note decreased Elfa third-party net sales. Now, Elfa is kind of a sub-brand that the Container Store holds, something they've been very bullish on for the last year or so. But in this case, it wasn't so much the lack of sales. Actually, they saw higher sales in their Nordic markets, but they saw multiple negative currency impacts due to a weak Swedish krona during the period. This also affected commodity costs at the subchain. But as we always say when we talk about an earnings call, we're more interested in the initiatives that the retailers have on deck than some of the actual numbers themselves, although 8.5% comp sales increases will get our attention every time. But to that end, the Container Store hit on a number of initiatives at just the right time, including, as we talked about, the custom closets pivot. They're working to continue to capitalize on the increased consumer trend towards storage, rolling out a new Avera product line, and the product line will exist entirely within the custom closets core, and as part of their play to capture storage market share while the getting is good. You're seeing a lot of social media influencers as well, something we'll talk about here in a second, really picking up on those organizational concepts. And they feel as though there's an overall lack of market awareness actually regarding custom closets. So as well as the brand is doing, they feel it could be doing that much better if there were some sort of market awareness, and that this lack of market awareness is created in part by product gaps in their business. They hope Avera will address these as kind of a mid-price option in their custom closets line for consumers. They have their mainline TCS options, but those are a little bit more expensive, and they're hoping Avera will kind of fill in this midline gap there. Now, as far as marketing is concerned, they've been able to hit on this recent popularity of home organization with some new advertising endeavors, and this has helped their bottom line at the same time with decreased marketing spend. So they feel like they're getting more out of their marketing dollars, but they're also able to spend less on marketing, which of course increases margins, helps them out financially. Literally, one of the first things the CEO, Melissa Reef, mentioned on the call was that the Container Store's partnership with the YouTube channel, What's Up Moms, was really beneficial to the Container Store, they felt like, in the first quarter. In fact, the Container Store partnered with them for a video shown on their channel, the What's Up Moms channel. To this point, that video, 3 million views. So here we see the value of new media marketing, similar to what Ulta has capitalized on over the last 5 years. Multiple studies have shown that partnering with a YouTube channel or a podcast, hint, hint, or some other form of new media actually has a better rate of return than traditional advertising channels, than their just the traditional radio or television ads or newspaper ads or print ads or freestanding inserts there. Now, their partnerships, not only with the YouTube channels that we discussed, but also other forms of social media and Jimmy Kimmel Live, were all credited for a spike in their social mentions of the Container Store in the fourth quarter. Additionally, you know, it's one thing to have social mentions, but if you go online and you look at social mentions of someone like Walmart, it's not all positive. But many of these mentions for TCS were positive, something they refer to in their metrics as positive social activities. And to this point, they actually just launched a brand ambassador program, basically tracking down active micro-influencers in their follower base to assist in forwarding their new brand message. And their new brand message is also on a lot of their traditional advertising that they've come out with, and it's where space comes from. So that's their new tagline. This, by the way, this whole process was all kind of foretold in our interview with Brett Bernstein of Gatsby nearly 2 years ago, whose company helps set companies up with micro-influencers that they might have. So basically, these influencers, or as they call them, ambassadors that are part of this program, what they do is they do projects in their customers' homes on a monthly basis and kind of show these products off on social media just as a way to kind of gain that notoriety for the Container Store and show off some of the things that you can do with Container Store products. So these different mechanisms, advertising on YouTube channels and setting things up with Jimmy Kimmel and these brand ambassadors online, all of this is almost taken right out of Ulta's playbook, but it seems to be working, and it's working to reduce costs as well for the Container Store.
A lot of genius ideas coming by way of social media. Brett Bernstein, by the way, a follow of ours on Twitter. If only we could have more Twitter users follow us. But one of the biggest things we're watching in terms of the Container Store is the construction of a new distribution center in Maryland, which will help out their increased store presence in the East Coast. This is crucial at a time when we're talking about retailers seeing distribution costs rise because of fuel and staffing issues. If we look at diesel fuel, Trent, just in the last month and a half, nationally, it's up about 5.5% to 6%. California is up about 6%, the state that I now live in. So while the absolute amount of cost doesn't seem like that great of a difference, the percentage increase is different. And staffing, by the way, is only going to get higher as states pass minimum wage hikes for their municipalities. If they can properly leverage this particular distribution center, it should result in somewhat decreased fuel costs, although perhaps not staffing costs, given the need to staff the DC in the first place. More than anything, though, it should be smooth in terms of building out their supply chain and getting goods quicker to their stores when needed. And the supply chain is an area that the Container Store has seen some ups and some downs over the past 5 years, certainly always mentioning it on their earnings calls. The only issue is that the distribution center that isn't planned for completion until late 2019. So that distribution center not being built for that amount of time means that they're still going to have some hiccups in the interim, and they don't anticipate returns on it until maybe fiscal 2020. So they'll have to deal with high fuel costs in the meantime. New store openings continue to be scaled back for them as well. Just 2 store openings planned during fiscal 2019 and just 1 relocation.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
That brings us to the final segment here on the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a story and take a glance at it as it might play out over the next week, month, or year. I'll go first here this week. My looking ahead story has to do with Bed Bath & Beyond, as their CEO, Stephen Tomaris, stepped down earlier this week. Now, it was credited to pressure from a group of activist investors, including Legion Partners Asset Management and Marcellum Advisors, as well as a few others there. But ultimately, you know, Tomaris has had a long run as the company's CEO, but things have kind of stalled out at Bed Bath & Beyond. Some people saying that they're not really jumping into the next generation stores as quickly as what they need to be, or their store of the future as quickly as what they need to be. As a result, Tomaris out of a job, but as I mentioned, had a long run at Bed Bath & Beyond. And look, ultimately it comes down to loss of a competitive edge for the company. Because remember, it's not just Bed Bath & Beyond. It's World Market, it's Bye Bye Baby and all of that. And I went on record on the podcast 3 years ago saying that I felt like Bed Bath & Beyond and Bye Bye Baby had this competitive moat of their registry programs. So both the bridal registry programs with Bed Bath & Beyond and the baby registry programs with Bye Bye Baby, even more so after Toys R Us kind of left the fray, with Babies R Us kind of falling out of the picture there as far as the registry is concerned. But the reason I mentioned this is you look at the registry program now for Bed Bath & Beyond, and it's really kind of a shell of its former self. I feel like the company kind of ignored it a little bit, didn't play it up as much. But, you know, I don't know if you're anything like me. I get invites to a lot of weddings, fewer and fewer weddings. In fact, none of the last six weddings I've been to have the bride and groom had a Bed Bath & Beyond registry, whereas it used to be standard issue. So I feel like they kind of lost ground in that. And maybe they saw, hey, registries aren't going to be as much of a thing. People are moving more towards gift cards, that type of thing. But they could have made it more of a thing. They could have really poured some efforts into it. But as we talked about constantly, we've covered their earnings calls over the last 3 to 4 years. They barely mentioned the registries at both of those retailers, instead deciding to focus on a few other things, a poorly timed acquisition of One Kings Lane, that type of thing. So all of this is looking back to look forward and say this: what's the next CEO that comes in on a full-time basis going to do? Now, Mary Winston is currently the interim CEO. She was formerly a board member, currently actually still a board member at Bed Bath & Beyond, but eventually they'll get a full-time CEO in there. What are they going to do? Are they going to continue pouring resources into these next generation stores, into these stores of tomorrow that Bed Bath & Beyond is trialing? Will they pour more resources into one of the subsidiaries over another? Do they see more potential at, say, World Market versus the flagship Bed Bath & Beyond store? What are they going to do with Bye Bye Baby? So a lot of questions to be answered here in the next 6 months to a year. And again, this is a situation where it's not as though the retailer was failing, but just stagnating. They just weren't growing, they weren't proceeding, and they weren't really fighting off the likes of Amazon and those other retailers that were kind of creeping in on them for market share, including retailers like Walmart and Target. So again, a lot to be determined here over the next 6 months to a year for this company.
Well, apropos of Bed Bath & Beyond's type of retail, and the type of retail that our last story dealt with in the Container Store, my looking ahead story has to do with, well, At Home, who is a much smaller retail than both of those stores, but an up-and-coming retailer that we've actually been a fan of as of late because of their ability to turn a profit. Most recently, they're in the news because Kohl's is apparently trying to decide whether or not they have a takeover bid in store for At Home. At Home, by the way, was recently discussed on this very podcast in regards to the rumors saying that they were looking to sell themselves, either become private or become taken over by a publicly traded company. The rumors, as of late, really point to the fact that they're looking at a potential sale to a private equity firm. However, because of this news, Kohl's being a publicly traded company, this is much bigger news in terms of what it means for the overall retail industry. And it leaves me guessing that Kohl's is looking at Home as a type of retailer where maybe they can leverage
more of their home decor segment and get a different type of customer base. However, this is a looking ahead more because of the strategy that At Home had employed, taking over larger but sometimes older stores. Think of Kmart's, think of Target's that left one location and maybe ended up getting an entirely new development that was a bit larger for their grocery section. So you really have to wonder, why would they buy a retailer that has much older stores and maybe a different demographic than Kohl's is known for, especially in a time where they're really trying to tout their relationship with Amazon and their omnichannel capability. Whereas 5 years ago, Kohl's basically had no omnichannel capability, and now they're going to deal primarily with At Home, who is just a brick and mortar store that is just now showing profitability. So if you look at Home's methodology, they were thinking that right now with their 180 stores in 37 states, they were going to grow long-term to 600 stores nationwide with either the same footprint or even larger in terms of the square footage for each individual store. And while we love brick and mortar, you really have to wonder what Kohl's sees in terms of a value proposition here. Because again, a company that profits just around $44 million in a particular quarter, what do they have that Kohl's could really benefit from? What vision is so revolutionary at Home that Kohl's sees it as a no-brainer buy? I think, honestly, this is something that is going to be borne out in the numbers as we look at a little bit closer in the coming weeks, in the coming months, if At Home does in fact sell. I'm very curious to see what ends up happening. But again, I'm a fan of brick and mortar, Trent. I would love to see this take place and to see some sort of out-of-the-box vision that maybe Kohl's has that we just can't wrap our minds around at this particular moment in time.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. One more time, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Give us a like or a rate wherever you do listen to us. We'll be back 1 week from now. In the interim, I'm going to go hug a Kmart.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.